The Jesse Brown's crew is here with you on the Carolina Outdoors. Wes Lawson over there, Bill Barty right here. And Wes, it is opening day.
Can you believe it? It finally showed up. It's not just opening day for one, but for two different seasons, Bill.
And we're going to cover that because that's what we do here on the Carolina Outdoors. If you've never listened to the Carolina Outdoors, this is your first time. Welcome aboard. Hopefully you'll learn something about the Carolina Outdoors. Maybe along the way you'll be inspired to participate. The people that listen, there are those getting up early, those who are coming in late, and everyone in between. Let us not forget the podcast, Highlights of the Carolina Outdoors, that opens it up to all listeners. But Wes, what seasons are we talking about opening today?
Well, we had a month off from over 1,000 miles of river and stream water, but trout season is back after 964,000. Almost a million fish were put in our rivers by the state, and April 1st is the start of the youth season for spring gobbler. Turkey season.
Spoken like a true fisherman, where you just go ahead and round up. 964,000, let's just call it 1 million.
May as well. What's a couple of thousand between friends? And then April 8th would be the opening day of turkey season at large in North Carolina. But the youth can get out there with an adult to go harvest some turkey, and anybody with a fishing license can go catch a trout.
It's fantastic. And of course, South Carolina, and South Carolina has different zones, four different zones that make up the state. They are opening as well. Private lands in zone 1 and 2 is April 1st through May 10th, and the managed lands in South Carolina for essentially the entire month of April is open starting today. So welcome turkey hunters that are getting out early. Of course, turkey has been one of the highlights of conservation over the past 30 years, and we're celebrating that here in the Carolinas. We have a spring season. You hailed from Virginia. Mm-hmm. You had a spring and a fall season up there.
Yeah, and actually we do have a very short winter season here in North Carolina. But yeah, I had spring and fall, which was always a bunch of fun. Now, I did say spring gobbler season.
Right.
Because it's for male turkeys, but also bearded turkeys. There are some females that have a beard. Bearded turkeys can be harvested, male or female, but generally speaking, if you know the difference, let's stick just to the males if we can in the spring season.
So a lot of people are getting up early to be where they need to be when these turkeys are coming off the roost.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned this. I think Don Yeager may have taught this. The benefits of a late morning hunt where you can get out.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to get up.
Mm-hmm.
We appreciate people getting up at 5 a.m.
Sure.
For sure, listening to WBT. But there's kind of that mid-morning hunt
mm-hmm.
that's worth noting. The turkeys have already gotten off the roost. They've moved. And then you slot in, set up, and you're there when they're coming back.
Yeah, so you know, they get off the roost and they go feed for usually a couple of hours. And this time of year, like so many wild animals, they're going after some seeds, but mostly it's going to be insects and things like that. After they feed, they're going to roost again so they can digest, because they don't chew their food. They just swallow it and it digests. So after they've spent a few hours doing that, it's now mid to late morning. And as they're going to find a safe place to bed down, there you are. Or they've already felt some predation and they're a little scared and they're moving. So it's a great time to get out there, and all the other wildlife has already moved around. You haven't spooked the entire ecosystem, which is a good thing too.
It's the one animal that many say, including Benjamin Franklin, most represents the American spirit, finishing second to being our icon for our country, our mascot. The symbol right behind the bald eagle.
At that time, there would have been a lot more turkeys, period. But you would have seen a lot more turkeys than bald eagles.
That makes sense. We're going to come back to that, because that fits into a latter segment that we're going to talk about of how things were compared to how they are now. So as we park turkey season in that opening day, we are going to pivot a bit and take a peek at trout season, because mm-hmm. April 1st, as you mentioned, is that hatchery-supported water, and we talked to Jake Rash, you can listen to highlights of the Carolina Outdoors to learn more about that. He's a cold water research coordinator for Wildlife Resource. He talked about hatchery-supported being closed in the month of March, but now it is open in April, and how all of that works. Wes, have you been out on opening day of trout season anywhere?
Yes, and when it's on April 1st, opening day on April 1st seems like a bad idea. This yeah. is, but it's not an April Fool's joke. It's real. It feels like a westward expansion shotgun start homesteading event. Like, it is insane, especially given how many of those fish are going to be released.
Right.
It's not like we're out there trying to fill the dinner table in most cases, but it's the largest gathering of strangers in the outdoors in one spot many of us will ever see.
So here on the Carolina Outdoors, we broadcast via the airwaves of WBT Radio early on a Saturday morning, mm-hmm. as well as highlights of the Carolina Outdoors via podcast. But the WBT part, they have an incredible traffic group, Boomer Von Cannon and Pam Warner and several others who monitor this. I vote that they go up to Wilson Creek, Brown Mountain Beach Road today, because not only is it opening day of trout season, April 1st, it's also a Saturday. And you put those two things together and you need some traffic reporting, because I have, and I can't even tell you how I got there, but I was not fishing. I was on Brown Mountain Beach Road on April 1st several years ago, pre-pandemic, just and it's amazing, because it is car after car after car.
Hundreds.
Game warden, wildlife officer. Game warden, wildlife officer, those are the same thing, by the way, but I just like to sprinkle. You say tomato, I say tomato.
Fish cup, yeah.
But they were everywhere, checking fishing mm-hmm. licenses. It was astounding to me. So it would be bring your own rock to stand on, but the fish are in there, and there's several fish that are going to go home with people for the skillet.
Yeah. Well, if cell phones got reception at Wilson Creek and you pulled up Google Maps or GPS map, it would look on there. It'd be a red line because red. None of those phones could move. It would be. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people, and I bet those wildlife conservation officers end up having to negotiate some people out of near fisticuffs over who fished whose spot, who blew the hole. It's wild. So when you're out there, do have your patience ready and do have your fishing license on hand. Save yourself the hassle. But it's going to be a beautiful day of a lot of people catching a lot of fish because, like I said, almost a million got put in all of our rivers, creeks, and streams.
It's opening day. Whether you're a turkey hunter or a trout fisherman or angler, welcome aboard. The Carolina Outdoors is talking about that. Wes Lawson, Bill Barty. We're also going to talk a little bit about the past and the future all in one segment. We're going to talk about the American chestnut and what it meant and what it's going to mean moving forward and how this is all happening, plus a list of events besides opening days of things. It's opening day of talking about the events that Jesse Browns is going to be participating in the upcoming weeks. You are invited. Stay tuned for more of the Carolina Outdoors. Hey, there's something pressing that I think we should do. We should do before we get too deep into spring. I wanted to talk about it here on the Carolina Outdoors. Welcome, everyone. This is Bill Barty on this side.
And Wes Lawson over here on the far side.
Let me tell you, Wes, what I did. And I've spoken about this area many times here on the Carolina Outdoors because I'm familiar with it. Maybe I'm a slow learner. I do not know. But the reason it's pressing is because I had a chance to go out to Kings Mountain mm-hmm. National Military Park. Mm-hmm. This is a federal park. The National Park Service is who operates it. It hugs up next to a South Carolina state park, which is a whole nother topic for a whole nother day here on the Carolina Outdoors. But I went, they have great rangers, mm-hmm. great park rangers in the National Park Service. But there was a new one who was at Kings Mountain National Military Park. And I had the opportunity to do a walk with him. He and maybe six other people, and it was a non-boring history hike.
Was Patsy Cline playing in the background?
No Patsy Cline, but I was able to enjoy their newer trail that they have, counterbouncy and springy, made of recycled rubber, tires, cool. That sort of thing, compounded. But why is it important that we go out there for this hike now? It's 1.5 mile, that's 1.5 miles for many of us, loop.
How many kilometers?
Uh-oh. We'll come back to that. But the growth of the trees, the greenery, all of that wasn't too vibrant yet.
Okay.
Therefore, it mimics really how it was back in 1780 during the Battle of Kings Mountain,
yep.
Which was called for many a turning point of the war. It mm-hmm. showed that Americans would fight. In mm-hmm. fact, it was only Americans versus Americans, Loyalists versus Patriots.
Only one Tories. British officer died?
That's right. It was Patrick Ferguson. And I had a whole new look at his situation as well. But what I really appreciated is if you drive by Kings Mountain, mm-hmm. many of us who live here in this area may look over there and see just a hill.
Yeah.
But it is a ridgeline. Now it's covered with trees and forest and is can be dense. They do manage it and do burns to keep some of the brush and whatnot away. But now before the green canopy comes back and all of that, it lets you see the view of the ridgeline, what they would have seen with a clear top, because Kings Mountain back yep. then was cleared. And during our walk, many things were pointed out, but one of them was the difference in the tools that each side was using.
Yeah.
The militia was using muskets, but the others, the Patriots, were using rifles. Now, do you know the difference between a musket and a rifle? It's not putting you on the spot, just rhetorical.
Yes.
You do know?
Yes.
Well, I don't think I did know. So rifles weren't used by armies back then. They were more of a hunting weapon, which is what the farmers and the citizens would have used on the frontier. So that's what the American militia was using. The loyalists had muskets.
Yeah. Yeah, so the rifles, the inside of the barrel has a steady twist, so the
yes.
so the musket ball, the projectile spirals, so it's more accurate. And if you had that as your primary means of putting meat on the table, you did not want to miss.
That's
good. But if you had to outfit a large army, as the British did, who were going to fire in volley style formation, essentially functioning like a 60-man shotgun,
right?
You didn't need individual accuracy, and it would cost too much. So why would you spend the money to have those things rifled if they really weren't aiming at the other side? They were just firing in unison.
Are you looking onto my paperwork? You're describing it precisely. That is right on. And the other thing was speed.
Mm-hmm.
Rifle fired once a minute, but a musket was easy to load, but inaccurate.
Yeah, and it would have been, you know, a fast, well-trained soldier might be able to reload one of those 3 or 4 times a minute,
yes.
maybe. But you couldn't sustain that. As the gun warms up, you've got to give it some time. You've got to clean them out every so often. I mean, it's a process.
Well, I learned that, and I really appreciated going back to getting out there before spring gets too far.
Mm-hmm.
A lay of the land.
Mm-hmm.
They have a wonderful brief film that they show on the battle. They have a nice museum. But from the outdoor component of a walk around the battlefield and the texture of the land that both sides were utilizing and how they were utilizing in the scheme of battles, I guess this would have been a relatively small one.
Yep.
But still meaningful, and it's so close to us here in Charlotte, it seems a waste not to go over there and have that understanding. And it was a beautiful day in the Carolinas for a hike. And then I just got this education along the way. To the one British citizen that was there, Colonel Patrick Ferguson, I always thought, and you know what, shame on me, maybe I just did not pay attention, but it was the normal tradition is to throw a rock on his grave.
Hmm.
And it is a big pile of rocks there, and I threw another rock on his grave. But the one new understanding that I have is he was a Scotsman, and it was a tradition of honor and respect to throw a rock on the deceased grave. That's part of that Scottish tradition. The American version was always to keep him down, kind of a tongue-in-cheek joke to make sure that guy was there. It was not ever out of disrespect, of hate, or throw it, which as a middle school kid, maybe I misunderstood that part.
Yeah, easily done. Well, you think about, you know, in today's technology, Kings Mountain is not far from where we sit right now because of cars. That would have been a solid day or two or three walk or horse ride. You could do it, I guess, in a day on a horse. The horse wouldn't like it.
right.
But even that battle, you know, the Over Mountain boys, no one had comfortable shoes, if they had shoes at all. Would have been moccasins of some sort. Clothes would have been ragtag. Hungry and thirsty. I mean, there's a lot went into that that we don't have a real understanding of. But that was a real turning point for everybody. That's exciting stuff.
Highly recommended to take comfortable shoes out there, maybe a water bottle, and enjoy learning a little bit of history while getting some good fresh spring air, Carolina air, in your lungs along the way. That's straight from the Carolina Outdoors, which is who we are, Wes Lawson, Bill Barty. We are from Jesse Brown's Outdoors, and Wes, with that being said, China Blackman in the Charlotte Observer just had something published, the most popular fashion trends in North Carolina. What would they be? Number one, cowboy boots and loafers.
Those are two very different styles of shoe.
What a combination. In North Carolina, cowboy boots and loafers are the most popular must-have fashion items, according to the fashion experts with Boohoo revealing the trends in the United States. This is based on Google search data and monthly search volume for fashion trends in each state. The list starts off 1 and 2, cowboy boots and loafers, followed by, and this is matches up with us, Chelsea boots. And, of course, at Jesse Brown's, we have the ever-fashionable Blundstone brand, the original Australian Chelsea boot on hand. Number 4, graphic tees, which we have at Jesse Brown's as well. Number 5 in popularity, puffer jackets, which we sell quite a few of, name brand of the Patagonia Nano Puff with the Primaloft lining. So these are also the top trends across the country overall, with cowboy boots being the most searched trend in 38 of our 50 states in the United States. Loafers are second most popular, with 12 states leading the way in searches.
Well, and, you know, without getting too into the weeds on it, cowboy boots as a category, I get.
Yes.
But technically, a cowboy boot has a raised heel and a pointed toe. I bet most of what we're seeing are ropers with that lower heel, not a Cuban or a bulldog heel, and a slightly more rounded toe. But, hey, you wear what's comfortable and looks good for you. They're all good.
Well, they had something to say. A Boohoo spokesperson said cowboy boots have been a popular fashion trend in the U.S. for many years, particularly in Western states, but they have only recently gained the momentum to reach mainstream fashion across the globe and are especially favored among festival goers and fashion enthusiasts who appreciate the style of Western wear.
Well, like the man said, my heroes have always been cowboys. But, you know, they've gotten more comfortable. I get that. I probably wouldn't want to go to a festival in them, but I'm sure Kevin Costner and a few other people have helped sell a lot of boots and Western wear in the last few years.
That's a good get.
But and they've been around for more than a minute. So have Chelsea boots. But Chelsea boots look a lot different now than Beetle boots, you know, what John...
So true.
John and Ringo had. But, you know, you get the right pair. They're comfortable and they're versatile. Loafers are kind of the same thing. To me, they're a torture device. But I get it. I get why people like them.
Rounding out the items on the list in North Carolina, bomber jackets, trench coats, sundresses, and here's one that's very popular, Jesse Brown's, shackets. Do you know what a shacket is?
Is it a shirt? Is it a jacket? Is it a schwacket?
It's a shacket.
Bomber jackets and trench coats. Really?
That's according to Boohoo.
Huh.
You need to get, I don't know if it's a pair of cowboy boots or not, but everyone reminded that April 23rd, one of the events that Jesse Brown's is participating in is the Urban Hike. We're meeting at Fair Meadows Swim and Racquet Club in the South Park area. It's going to be a 7.7-mile hike, but we're going to have guides pointing out historical places, points of interest, and we're going to finish up at Legion Brewing there in the South Park area. If you're late and can't meet us at 1 at Fair Meadows on April 23rd, that's a Sunday, then you will see us walking along the way, the Greenway and the other parts of the trail. This is not just a sidewalk hike. Don't think you're going to be walking down Fairview Road necessarily. It's going to be a wonderful hike had by all, and you are invited. Also, that same week, the Thursday, Storytellers Night at Jesse Brown's. Come hear a neighbor's adventure. That's April 27th at 6 o'clock. We've got three brand new stories hitting the stage at Jesse Brown's Outdoors. For more details, go over to jessebrowns.com. And on that topic, go to jessebrowns.com not only to hear highlights of the Carolina Outdoors, but you can go to our news that we have. There's a great news article. If you do not follow us on Facebook or Instagram, please jump over to jessebrowns.com. Hit the news, because there is big news in the South Park area and how it's going to impact a local Charlotte outfitter.
Dun, dun, dun.
He's Wes Lawson. I'm Bill Barty. Back after this. Let's go back in time a little bit. Over 100 years ago, what the landscape of our natural forests would have been across America, but especially here in the Carolinas. Welcome, everyone, to the Carolina Outdoors. I'm Bill Barty.
And I'm Wes Lawson.
Wes, over 100 years ago, 25% of our natural forest, something that was relied on by people for food, it was relied on for animals for food, it was relied on for homesteads, cabins, buildings across the land to be built. It was a tree called the American chestnut.
Which would be, of course, a deciduous tree of the beech family. Bill, I told you this earlier. Once upon a time in Europe, books were made out of beech
wood. Yes.
They were tablet, and in German, that was called a Bach, which sounds an awful lot like book. That is where we get the term book.
Learned it here on the Carolina Outdoors, beech to Bach to book. Well, in related news, I guess if the chestnut is in that beech tree family, we're going to learn a little bit about trees. But something really bad happened at the turn of the 20th century. It was a bacterial blight that came in from Asia and decimated over 4 billion of the American chestnut trees.
That's a billion with a B.
With a B. So is it all for naught? Is it gone? The American Chestnut Foundation says no, and with that, we're going to bring on Doug Gillis from the American Chestnut Foundation to give us a lay of the land here in the 21st century regarding this tree. Doug, welcome.
Well, thank you, Bill. Thanks, and Wes. Glad to be on.
Well, we always love having you, especially when you're bringing good news. Now, this is good news involving the long run. We kind of gave that background of the American chestnut, but you know things that are happening now, planning for the future. Talk to us about the 21st century chestnut tree and the plan to, regain its foothold in this country from where it used to be over 100 years ago.
Yes, the American Chestnut Foundation is involved in restoring the American chestnut to our eastern forest and woodlands. So one effort is a breeding program been going on for more than 30 years to introduce blight resistance from Chinese chestnuts into Americans, and then selecting the best of those to continue with a breeding effort to bring the tree back into the forest. But a new development is a Darling 58 transgenic American chestnut tree, which has a wheat gene inserted into it, and then that wheat gene reacts to the fungus that attacks the tree and keeps it from killing it. So the tree lives even though it's being attacked. So that is a very promising new development.
Well, and so that involves three different things, and I guess you just mentioned them, but I'm going to ask you about the third thing. The three items making up that Darling 58 project: there's traditional breeding, biotech breeding or biotechnology involved in that you just mentioned. The third is biocontrol. Can you talk to us about what that is? Is that keeping people from the tree?
Well, the biocontrol actually refers to another effort to use a virus called a virus that attacks the blight and kind of develops in conjunction with the fungus that's on the tree and then keeps it from killing the tree. So it's just another effort to use other controls beyond the breeding and the Darling 58 tree to help restore the American chestnut. So, yeah, there's a lot of different things underway and efforts to bring the tree back into the forest.
So, Doug, you know, the American chestnut at one time had a large, dense range, and it was a big tree, 100 feet with a circumference of almost 13 feet. That's changed a little bit post-blight, which now has been over 100 years, but how will the Darling 58, do we know kind of how it will grow, what it will be like with this little bit of sort of biomedical engineering to help save this species?
Well, the advantage of the Darling 58 is that it's got all of the genes of the American chestnut, so the only different gene is this wheat gene that gives it the ability to resist the fungal attacks from chestnut blight. So it should grow just as tall as the American chestnuts in the past have grown, and is big in diameter. Now, these big trees you're referring to, they may be 100 or more years old, and fortunately, there's some of these trees still around, but they're out on the West Coast. Pioneers took seedlings and seed west with them, planted them back in the 1800s, and I've had the privilege of going and standing underneath some of these big trees, so that's just part of the promise of what can happen back here in the east with restoration of the trees in our eastern forest.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have seen a chestnut tree and they don't know it, because I think the average person walking around can pick out a pine tree and maybe a cedar tree. What is it? How would we find a chestnut amongst all the others?
Well, it's helpful to be able to identify especially the leaves, because once there are seedlings out in the forest, this fungus does not attack the roots, so trees will sprout up and get sometimes 6-8 inches in diameter before the blight attacks them and kills them. But a good resource is the American Chestnut Foundation website, acf.org. And there, not only can you look at the Darling 58 tree and learn a lot about it by clicking on that on the banner, you can also drop down and see something that says, "Have you found a chestnut?" Click on there, and then there'll be information about how to identify the various species of chestnut, especially the American chestnut. It has a very distinctive leaf, kind of long canoe-shaped with teeth that curl on the very end. So it's easy to identify once you know what to look for. And American Chestnut Foundation is encouraging people to get out in the woods and find wild Americans. And we use those in our breeding program, especially with this Darling 58 being released hopefully this summer. We'll be able to pollinate wild Americans and then produce more diversity into the number of trees that are available for restoration.
And some species of trees don't need another to pollinate, but chestnut, American chestnut trees cannot self-pollinate. Is that correct?
That's correct. It takes two to cross. They will cross with other varieties, but you need the two different trees. And fortunately, there are trees in the woods still that are close enough together that they will cross-pollinate. And we have a member here in the Carolinas that collects a lot of nuts walking the Appalachian Trail. We have an event planned on April 15th at our seed orchard in Edneyville, North Carolina, which is between Back Cave and Hendersonville. And we'll be planting a lot of wild Americans, and then we'll be using those later as they grow up and start flowering to cross with this Darling 58 pollen.
Yeah, I guess, and if you're just joining us here on the Carolina Outdoors with Wes Lawson and Bill Bartee, we're talking to Doug Gillis from the American Chestnut Foundation about this heritage tree that was so large, and we've lost in the past 100-plus years 4 billion of them. But, Doug, we didn't really necessarily lose them all. The tree never went extinct. It still grows from the roots. It's just when it gets up to a certain size that the blight strikes. Even today, I don't know if it's 10 feet, 15 feet, nothing like the, you know, tens of feet, 80-foot trees that it was. But is that correct? The tree can still grow. It's just once it gets to a certain height, the old original American chestnut, then it's stricken by the blight?
Right. The tree still survives out of the forest, and it will get up to as much as 6 or 8 inches in diameter. But ultimately, the blight resides on other trees, and it'll find an American chestnut and then enter into the bark and girdle the tree. Everything above that point dies. Now, sprouts may continue from stumps, and the tree just tries to keep replicating itself, but it has no natural ability to resist this fungal blight attack. And so these trees we're breeding, especially the Darling 58, will have resistance and can survive out in the forest and resist the blight and grow to large size eventually.
Now, at one point, chestnut trees, American chestnut trees in particular, were highly sought after because the wood was so easy to saw and to work with, but still so strong like other hardwoods. It didn't have kind of the radial end that can make it hard to work with. It was sort of unique, but here in Charlotte there is at least one known location that the interior of the building was entirely constructed from pre-blight American chestnut. Is that correct?
Yes. Hawthorne Lane United Methodist Church may be what you're referring to.
There, yes, sir.
Is a the sanctuary has chestnut wood in it and a vaulted ceiling made of chestnut wood. I think that was constructed about 1915.
Wow. So Hawthorne Lane Methodist Church has an interior design of chestnut, and that was not uncommon, I guess, because that was the prevalent, again, 25% of the natural forest made up of the American chestnut. And we're talking to Doug Gillis about that with the American Chestnut Foundation. Doug, you mentioned April 15th, but on April 22nd, Earth Day, there's going to be a debuting of a new, I guess it's a documentary on the chestnut. Are you going to be on hand for that? And tell us about that debut.
I'll be attending this premiere showing of the documentary film that's titled Clear Day Thunder, Rescuing the American Chestnut, about a 40-minute long film will be shown there. And then later it'll be available for people to schedule showings. We're hopeful to maybe have a showing at the Arboretum again at a later date. The public will be able to attend this first showing on the 22nd of April. Is by invitation only right now. But the film itself, you can go on to the acf.org website, and up on the top banner there's a place to click Chestnut Documentary, and you can see a trailer for the film to just whet people's appetite.
And, well, it's got a lot of stars in there. You got some Allman Brothers in there, Dolly Parton's in there, President Jimmy Carter. They're all a part of this documentary.
Oh, yeah, they're some of the luminaries, and so it's interesting. Chuck Lavelle, for example, a keyboardist, I believe, for Rolling Stones and Allman Brothers, he is a tree grower in Georgia. I don't think many people know that, but he's a conservationist. And Dolly Parton, she got involved because of her uncle Bill Owens, was very, very much interested in American chestnut. And President Jimmy Carter, he's a honorary member of the American Chestnut Foundation on their board, and I was fortunate to meet him a number of years ago and talk to him about the American chestnut. But it's nice to have all those people that are helping promote the restoration of the American chestnut.
No kidding. For Chuck Lavelle. Most of those rock stars are growing something else out there in the woods, not chestnut trees.
Well, I don't know about that. But
he went from planting pot to potting plants, Bill.
I'm glad you got there. Sorry, Doug. We went on.
You're okay. But I mean, truthfully, where would we be without Dolly Parton? I mean, every time.
Oh, yeah.
That lady, she's the last great American, I tell you what.
She is amazing in everywhere. And I guess, Doug, we can go to acf.org to learn about all of that, whether it be the Chestnut documentary, whether it be about the Earth Day things going on, whether it be about the Darling 58 tree. But what about the local group? How do we participate? Can we also get to you through the acf.org?
Yes. Well, we encourage people to join.
Yes.
And it's very economical. For $40 a year, you can join, be a member. And if you're in the Carolinas, you're all automatically a member of the Carolinas chapter, the state you live in. And notices will be posted on the Carolina chapter webpage. That'll announce opportunities to volunteer. We also just maintain a list of people interested in volunteering, so they get notices sent out to alert them to these opportunities. So you get to go out into an orchard area, help plant seedlings or maintain trees that are in the orchard. We encourage people to just organize hikes, go out and look for American chestnuts and identify their location and report those back to us. So there are a lot of good opportunities, yes.
Doug, this might be a bad question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because if you are traveling from one forest to another, is there a chance of spreading the spore from a sick tree to a well tree even now?
Yeah, that is a possibility, and we encourage people not to wear the same shoes or clothing or carry a backpack that they've been out in the woods with when they're going to look particularly at an American chestnut that is a very prized tree. So people need to take precautions. Root rot's another problem, so it attacks the roots, but we actually, when we're planting those trees to test them out and see what their resistance to root rot is, we'll use water with chlorine bleach in it, just cleaner tools, cleaner shoes, make sure we don't spread the spores from the root rot pathogen.
Well, what you have worked on the past 30 years or so is a gift to the future, because it is a part of the legacy, returning this iconic heritage tree that made up 25% of our natural forest, because it'll be, you know, moving into the future, that returning this iconic chestnut to its native range will matter. Doug Gillis, American Chestnut Foundation, thank you for jumping on with us here on the Carolina Outdoors.
Well, you're very welcome, and like I say, I encourage you to join, and other people join, help restore this tree back to the eastern forest.
Go to acf.org for more information and to join. Just as he said, we're going to take a quick break, come back, and wrap up the Carolina Outdoors. He's Wes Lawson. I'm Bill Barty. After these messages. Hey, a few quick reminders. Next week on the Carolina Outdoors, we're going to go Facebook Live. You're welcome to join us. Jesse Brown's CLT Facebook. Please join in. You can see what's going on around Jesse Brown's. Keep up with what's going on here on the Carolina Outdoors. And if you've missed this entire program today, do not worry. Head over to jessebrowns.com, highlights of the Carolina Outdoors. It's also available wherever you listen to podcasts, so you don't have to wake up so early on a Saturday morning.
Yeah, you can do it while you're cutting the grass or washing the car, whatever you do when you're listening to podcasts.
Changing diapers.
Yeah, you know Griffin Gideon is.
All of that. But anyway, we're Facebook Live. That's every first Thursday of each month, 1:30 p.m. You can ask questions, join in. We won't say heckle the host, but you can participate.
Yeah. And if you're listening right now on your way to the trout stream, make sure you have that fishing license.
Oh, please.
For goodness sake. And, you know, let us know how it went, how your fly selection was. Were you doing dries, dry droppers, nymphs, double nymphs? Were you Euro nymphing? What were you doing? How was it working? Don't worry. It's not a deep, dark secret anyway. We just want to have a conversation with you. And if you went for opening day of youth turkey season, let us know what you saw. Harvest numbers have been pretty good the last few years. Over the last five or six, it's been consistent, but it's getting better. That sounds like... There's a Tom calling back out to that hen. If only y'all could see what I'm looking at right now. If only you could.
There's so many sounds on this machine. Listen, listen, Wes Lawson, all good things sometimes come to an end. You've been a part of the Carolina Outdoors for the past, let's just go ahead and round up, 4 years, a true Renaissance man with a wide variety of experience, travel, wisdom that you've brought to the program. Thank you for sharing it over those years with us here on the Carolina Outdoors, but also for us at Jesse Brown's, because... from here on, you're about to move on to a new adventure with our friends at Mountain Khakis.
Yeah, so just across town. So just kind of changing an email address. It's been something special. Didn't think I'd ever be on a radio show. So that's been a heck of a thing. It's been a whole bunch of fun, and it's been fun for people to stop us and say, "I recognize your voice."
Well, isn't that fun? Well, you've been a great part of this program. We are definitely going to miss you. We do have a close association with Mountain Khakis. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, if you go to highlights of the Carolina Outdoors, you can hear some of the past members of the Mountain Khaki team, an American apparel brand that really birthed itself over at Jesse Brown's Outdoors. So, hey, how about you come back over for a visit?
That'd be all right. You know, I bought my first pair of Mountain Khakis at Jesse Brown's long time ago.
So this won't be goodbye. It'll just be so long for now. Listen, thanks to Doug Gillis from the American Chestnut Foundation for joining us on this week's Carolina Outdoors. For Wes Lawson and TJ Boggs, this is Bill Barty saying,
just
make the Carolina Outdoors look a little bit better than you found it. And pick up your trash.